From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Global. Hi, I'm Jim Stevenson. Welcome to our daily collection of popular VOA podcasts, including Daybreak Asia, on which we hear the verdict of a case involving a brutal killing in Afghanistan. Authors on Asia brings us the story of women gaining increasing influence in Korean society, long dominated by men. Sarah Williams aims the China Focus spotlight on Hong Kong's democracy movement. Ira Melman grinds out 19th century food in the American Cafe, while an inventor seeks to improve the survival of premature babies. That's on today's edition of Now with David Byrd. Steve Norman plays us the distinctive sounds of New Orleans jazz. We'll also be checking in with the latest business news and sports. It's all coming up today on VOA Global from the Voice of America. This is Daybreak Asia. Hi, and welcome to our summary of Asian news and events for Thursday, May 7th. I'm Jim Stevenson. Among today's headlines, a court in Afghanistan has sentenced four men to death and imprisoned eight more for the beating death of a woman in March. Aisha Tanzim has more for us now from Kabul.
Farkhunda's mother stood in front of a courtroom in Kabul Wednesday morning and asked for justice for her 27-year-old daughter. The judge responded by announcing a death sentence for four men and 16 years imprisonment for another eight. Among the condemned was Mullah Zainul Abidin, who accused Farkhunda falsely of desecrating the Muslim holy book, the Quran. But the judge added that this verdict was not final and they had the right to appeal. The men listened with stoic faces. The 20-minute process was the culmination of a trial that started last Saturday and lasted only 5 days. Farkhunda was killed by a mob in March after being accused of burning a Quran. Cell phone video showed people beating her with sticks, pushing her body from a rooftop and running it over with a car before dragging it through streets of Kabul, burning it and dumping it in the river. Her violent death sparked a wave of protests and demands for action. The administration promised swift justice. 30 civilians and 19 police officers were arrested and charged with either participating in the attack or failing to stop it. Wednesday's court hearing was to announce the verdict for the civilians, 18 of whom were acquitted for lack of evidence. The verdict for the 19 police officials will be announced Sunday. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Kabul.
The new constitution, drafted by Thailand's military-backed government, is aimed at returning the country to democratic rule, but the draft version is already under criticism by a wide range of political parties. Ron Corbin reports for VOA from Bangkok that the reaction raises some doubts over the charter's goals of ending years of political polarization.
This will be the 20th constitution since Thailand became a constitutional monarchy in 1932, and its supporters say it tries to succeed where the others failed to create a stable and enduring democracy. But it has already drawn opposition from the country's two major political parties, who say it weakens their influence and will do little to end the political polarization that has divided the country over the past 15 years. Panattan Wattaniagorn is a political scientist and an advisor to the government, who says the country's two major parties could mount a serious challenge to the draft before it is scheduled to be finalized in August.
It's not going to be tough moves, especially with Kuatai. Members, because they saw themselves as a loser, from this constitution. The Democrats, not much the same, but still, they are not that happy, because the constitution is aimed to reduce the power, at least to create a more equal balance.
The charter creates a 450-seat House of Representatives, whose members are elected under a proportional representation system that analysts say will lead to a greater number of lawmakers from smaller political parties. This would weaken the influence of major political parties, creating a greater need for coalition governments. An upper house 200-member Senate will comprise some elected members, but also nominated groups including former members of the military and bureaucracy, as well as representatives of labor, farmers, academics, and grassroots organizations. For the last 15 years, Thailand has been divided between two major parties that have battled on the streets and through the ballot box for control of the government. On one side are the populist parties backed by former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat, a billionaire businessman who lives in exile. His parties have won every election since 2001, largely through the support of rural Thais. On the other side, Thailand's Democrat Party, the country's oldest political party and one that includes many of the country's wealthy elite. Analysts say the main test will be now how the military government will gain public support and legitimacy for the charter. Earlier media reports indicated the government will not conduct a referendum on the constitution in the coming months, but officials have not announced a decision. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
From online retail, textbook rental companies to digital advertising, India is witnessing a boom in online startups. And helping these young, tech-savvy entrepreneurs fund their businesses are global investors eyeing the growth of Indian technology firms. Anjana Pasricha also has her eye on them, as she tells us more from New Delhi.
Along with two friends, 32-year-old Jaydeep Manchanda quit his job in a media group 4 months ago to launch a venture that advises companies about digital advertising strategies. He took the plunge after seeing that Indian firms lag those in developed markets like the United States in reaching customers by way of the internet.
This industry is almost at least 10 years behind, if not anything else, in India. Even the biggest of the companies, they are still wondering as to when and how they should revamp their digital marketing budgets. There are a lot of companies which don't even have a clue as to what they need to do.
As the number of internet users in India grows to about 300 million, many young people like Manchanda are trying to harness the massive potential of online businesses. Unlike the Indian information technology companies that mushroomed in the 1980s to set up massive outsourcing centers for Western companies, the new startups are tapping the consumer potential of the country's huge middle class. Only 25% of the 1.2 billion population is presently online, but fast-growing sales of smartphones are fueling internet access at a furious pace. A recent report by the industry body says that India is now the fourth largest startup hub in the world, with more than 3,000 new companies. Over the next 5 years, that number is expected to grow to 11,500. NASSCOM Senior Director Rajat Tandon says the time is right for people to go out and live their dreams.
The inflection point where people, rather than going and working for multinationals, are today looking at having the idea and work for themselves and actually make it big. As you've really seen the buzz which is happening on the ecosystem right now, I think this is probably the most interesting period for the startups.
The thriving entrepreneurial culture has been fueled by success stories of local online companies such as Flipkart and Snapdeal that reached multi-billion dollar valuations last year. While online retail is grabbing the most attention, technology startups are tapping customers in a host of other areas, renting textbooks, selling used goods or notebooks for school students, price comparison portals, booking tickets. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Daybreak Asia is a weekday feature of VOA. At voanews.com, we have longer versions of these stories, many of which have great photos and video. Our Daybreak Asia podcast is there as well. You may subscribe to it for free.
Here at VOA, we love to hear what you have to say about the stories that we produce each and every day. And we can read all of your comments from our website at voanews.com. One of our stories that we have posted at our website, a court in Afghanistan sentencing 4 men to death and imprisoning 8 more for the beating death of a woman in March. The judge responded by announcing a death sentence for the 4 men and 16 years imprisonment for another 8. It was a 20-minute process, the culmination of a trial that began last Saturday and lasted only 5 days. The woman was killed by a mob in March after she was accused of burning a Quran. Heron from Afghanistan writes, "I think it is still no fair justice for the family. Afghanistan courts shall have investigated more than these days. Where is the Kabul security chief officer among the offenders?"
Charles writes the death sentence should serve as a deterrent to other mullahs who use their so-called authority about Islam to feast on the psyche of people. This is unmanageable. If this sort of death could happen to a Muslim, one is left to imagine what the fate of Christians could face. Killing a human for the mere fact that she was accused of burning a piece of paper with some inscriptions that is supposedly from a man thought to be a prophet is unthinkable. More opinions on other stories. A new reality TV show in Vietnam has been put on hold for wrongfully depicting the capital of Hanoi as being inside Chinese territory. Also, the disputed Spratly and Paracel Islands claimed by Vietnam in the South China Sea were omitted from the map. Pulsab writes to us, the VTV show was punished for leaking the national top secret. They can only broadcast this show after the year 2020, he writes. A joke. Well, you can write whatever you like about our stories and post them on our website at voanews.com. This is VOA Global from the Voice of America. We have many ways that you can reach us other than our website. One of our favorites is our email address, voaasia@voanews.com. We get emails all the time from our listeners. And if you have anything to say about our program, our stories, feel free, write to us. We'd love to hear from you. Also, visit us on Facebook. Our Facebook page is VOA Asia.
South Korea has changed dramatically since the rule of controversial military dictator Park Chung-hee, who decades ago perpetuated a suppression of civil rights in the country and was especially harsh with regard to the role of women in society. I'm Jim Stevenson with Authors on Asia. We open the book today with Sung Kyung Kim, professor and chair of the Women's Studies Department and director of the Center for East Asian Studies at the University of Maryland. Her book, The Korean Women's Movement and the State, examines resistance in Korean social movements.
I wanted to do something that is fair rendition of what has been going on at the time in early 2000s. The most important part that I thought was how academy and the government and the civil society, how this three-way dynamics would be playing out to affect women's lives.
You were recounting, at least in the preface, being a college student and writing for the school newspaper, which must have been a very interesting time and gave you a lot of fundamental ideas for this.
In many ways, we were shut out of our college years by demonstrations, shutting down of the college, and thinking about what does, you know, the social movement mean to the society that was evolving like South Korea at the time and, you know, afterwards, 80s, 90s, and now, you know, we're talking about 2014, and the role of women in all of these years, in not only in the student movement and labor movement, but in this book, of course, in women's movement.
Well, in just six chapters, you cover some of the seminal events of the women's movement in South Korea over the past decade. The enactment of the law against prostitution in 2004 was a turning point in this movement.
Yes. That law in 2004, which many, and I will say many and maybe most, of Korean feminist scholars I'm talking about and women's movement organization activists all thought prostitutes will embrace this law wholeheartedly. And they were surprised when prostitutes staged demonstration after demonstration saying that this law does not and is not going to help them.
We like to say here in the United States that all politics is local, and you write about the personal and family aspects of politics from the mid-2000s on, particularly the abolition of the family head system and then rolling into the family law and child care policy.
Yes. Ever since the family law was established in 1948 and onward, women's organizations wanted to revise the family law. Abolishing the family head system was a fundamental change in Korean society, and it signaled in a way that there is no going back.
No matter what the social change and the degrees of it, there's always something to look forward to or something to press ahead with. And that's pretty much your conclusion, that the Korean women's movement is currently at a crossroads with such issues still needing some work and attention.
That's absolutely right. The movement activism will again gather its forces and will deal with the issues that they are facing with. I hope this book will be read by ordinary Korean women who want to find out about, so what happened to those legal changes and who made it happen and who were affected.
Sungkyun Kim, professor and chair of the Women's Studies Department and director of the Center for East Asian Studies at the University of Maryland, also author of The Korean Women's Movement and the State, Bargaining for Change. It's published by Routledge. I'm Jim Stevenson. We'll pull another volume from our bookshelves next week when you may hear more authors on Asia on VOA Global or anytime by visiting the VOAnews.com website, VOA Asia Facebook page, and SoundCloud.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focused. In Hong Kong, there are continuing political tensions as pro-democracy legislators vow to veto Beijing's plan for electoral reform in the city. Shannon Van Sant reports from Hong Kong.
Democracy activists say they will canvass Hong Kong over the next several weeks to educate the population and build support for direct elections of the city's leader. Last year, pro-democracy activists shut down parts of the city for months in what became known as the Umbrella Revolution. Protesters opposed a plan set forth by Beijing that fell short of their desires for a direct election of the city's leader. Earlier this year, Hong Kong's government revealed a plan for electoral reform, which is almost identical to Beijing's proposed reforms. The plan allows for voting for the city's leader, but from a pool of candidates chosen by a committee backed by loyalists to the Chinese central government. Emily Lau, head of Hong Kong's Democracy Party, says she and other pro-democratic lawmakers will not allow the electoral reform plan to pass.
Well, I think the proposal by the Hong Kong government, which of course is based on the decision by the Beijing government, is not good enough. It does not meet the very basic demands of a genuine democratic elections. So we are going to vote against it. I think many of the pro-democracy members in the Legislative Council are going to vote against it.
After Hong Kong's government revealed their reform plan, pro-democracy legislators walked out of the city's parliament building, most wearing black T-shirts with yellow crosses in protest of the government proposal. Two-thirds of the legislators need to approve the plan for it to pass, and as it now stands, Beijing and the Hong Kong government would have to convince four of the pro-democracy legislators to switch sides for the electoral reforms to become law. Speaking to reporters, Hong Kong's chief executive, C.Y. Leung, issued a warning to the city's citizens. He said, quote, "To initiate any political reform process is not easy. If this proposal is vetoed, it might be several years before the next opportunity." But many Hong Kong citizens, especially the city's youth, say if the reform plan were to pass the legislature, it would be a step back for the pro-democracy movement.
Well, I think that the best scenario is that it will be vetoed because to show that the people of Hong Kong is not like will not be cheated by this fake proposal, fake reform.
The pro-democracy movement has splintered since protests drew hundreds of thousands of demonstrators onto Hong Kong streets last year. Many students have chosen to leave Hong Kong's Federation of Students, one of the main organizers of the demonstrations, because of disagreements over the direction of the movement. Some students say they favor more radical action and have staged protests along Hong Kong's border with the mainland, surrounding mainland tourists and shoppers and shouting racist epithets and threats. But although the student movement for democracy may be split over its tactics, the movement as a whole appears to have broad support among the population. In a recent poll, fewer than half of Hong Kong residents said they supported the government plan for electoral reform in the city. The proposal was least popular among Hong Kong's well-educated youth. 55% of those surveyed with a college education or above were against the proposal, while 63% of those between the ages of 18 and 29 were against it. Although no mass protests against the proposal are planned, Joseph Chung, a professor at the City University of Hong Kong, says demonstrations could begin again if pro-democracy legislators switch sides and the reform proposal is passed.
If some pro-democracy legislators have been persuaded to change their position and endorse the political reform bill, then it is expected that there will be pretty large-scale protest activities initiated by the student groups in general.
Last week, in a small pro-democracy protest in the Hong Kong neighborhood of Mong Kok resulted in the arrest of 8 demonstrators. Television footage showed police using pepper spray and batons to disperse dozens of protesters who were attempting to block traffic. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Hong Kong.
Chinese officials in a village in Xinjiang province have ordered Muslim shopkeepers and restaurant owners to sell alcohol and cigarettes. Radio Free Asia reports the new requirement is perceived as an effort to try to undermine the influence of Islam on area residents. Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
From the Voice of America, this is Asia Business News. I'm Jim Stevenson. Hong Kong stocks followed mainland markets lower Wednesday, surrendering earlier gains, with infrastructure and industrial stocks leading a slight decline. The Hang Seng Index fell almost 0.5% to close at 27,640, while the China Enterprises Index also lost about that same amount to finish at 13,997. Bucking the trend, Chinese automaker Dongfeng Motor Group Corporation rose 1.1% after its state-owned parent appointed a new chairman amid media reports the government was preparing to merge it with its peer company, China FAW Group Corporation. Meanwhile, Alibaba's dominance at home as a marketplace for buyers and sellers of goods is being undermined by the Chinese economy, projected to grow at the slowest pace since 1990. Also, a consumer shift to mobile shopping that's crimping advertising revenue. About $70 billion of market value has evaporated from Alibaba since November, as investors are worrying about slowing growth. Chairman Jack Ma's push outside of China also has yet to gain traction. Its presence in the United States and much of Europe remains negligible. Results due Thursday are expected to show that the pace of Alibaba's revenue expansion fell below the average of the previous 7 quarters. Shares of Alibaba closed Tuesday at nearly $80 in New York. That's 33% below their November peak and the lowest since the Hangzhou-based company sold stock at $68 each in its September initial public offering. Alibaba's success in China made it the nation's biggest e-commerce operator, with everything from clothes and food to jets and cars being sold across its platforms. That's a look at Asia Business News from the Voice of America.
This is Today in History. On May 7, 1763, Chief Pontiac, the leader of the Ottawa Indian tribe and the head of an alliance of other tribes, attempted to take British-held Fort Detroit by surprise. The British had been forewarned, and Pontiac had to resort to a siege. While Fort Detroit held out, a number of other British forts fell. Such pan-tribal alliances only temporarily slowed the movement of European settlers westward. On this day in 1833, Johannes Brahms was born in Hamburg, Germany. Brahms was one of the most significant classical romantic composers of the 19th century. In 1840, another famous composer, Russian Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky, was born. Tchaikovsky was perhaps the most popular Russian composer of all time. In 1915, a German submarine off the coast of Ireland torpedoed the British ocean liner, the Lusitania. The passenger ship sank in less than 20 minutes, taking the lives of nearly 1,200 people. In 1945, the German High Command signed an unconditional surrender of all forces in France, effectively ending German involvement in the Second World War. At Soviet insistence, a second surrender document was signed in Berlin. In 1954, French forces surrendered their besieged stronghold at Dien Bien Phu in northwest Vietnam to Viet Minh forces, signaling the end of French colonial rule in Indochina.
In 2000, Vladimir Putin was inaugurated president of Russia. The former KGB officer soon became the most influential political leader in post-Soviet Russia. 12 years later, he was inaugurated again for president. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Coming up, Israel's prime minister narrowly meets a deadline to form a new coalition government. Britain's prime minister and opposition leader make final appeals to voters a day before an unpredictable election. And the head of the Italian Red Cross appeals for more international sympathy for the migrants risking deadly journeys across the Mediterranean. I'm Michael Lippin. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has met a key deadline to form a coalition government almost 2 months after his ruling Likud party emerged as the strongest faction in parliamentary elections. Just an hour before a midnight deadline on Wednesday, Mr. Netanyahu reached a deal with the ultranationalist Jewish Home Party to join a nationalist Likud-led coalition. The deal gives the Israeli prime minister a slim 61-seat majority in the 120-member parliament, or Knesset. Mr. Netanyahu's Likud holds 30 of those seats. As part of the agreement, he approved the Jewish Home's demand for one of its members to be appointed as Israel's next justice minister. Mr. Netanyahu then sent a message to Israel's president, as required by law, saying he had secured the parliamentary majority. The prime minister now has 1 week for parliament to hold a vote approving the government. The new Israeli coalition also includes a center-right party and two ultra-Orthodox Jewish factions. British Prime Minister David Cameron and opposition leader Ed Miliband are making final appeals to voters ahead of Thursday's parliamentary election, which surveys show is too close to call. A national survey released on Wednesday showed that Mr. Cameron's ruling Conservative Party has support of 33% of British voters, while Miliband's Labour Party was just 1 point behind. The polling suggests that either of Britain's two main political parties could be forced to form a new coalition government with at least one of several smaller parties in the 650-member House of Commons. Mr. Cameron, Britain's leader since 2010, has promised, if re-elected, to hold a referendum on whether Britain should stay in the 28-nation European Union. He also has highlighted his government's record on the British economy, the world's fifth largest.
It comes down to a choice of leadership. Whether you want me to continue leading our country and taking it forward, or whether you want Ed Miliband and you go back to the start and waste the work of the last 5 years.
Well, Miliband has attempted to characterize Mr. Cameron's Tories as the party of the wealthy.
You know, friends, I think this is the clearest choice before the British people in a generation. Between a Tory government that only works for the privileged few or a Labour government that would put working families first again.
More than 45 million people are eligible to vote at 50,000 polling stations throughout Britain. French investigators say a co-pilot who deliberately crashed a Germanwings airliner into the French Alps in March apparently practiced the maneuver during an earlier flight on the same day. The investigators said Wednesday that they found the altitude settings on that earlier flight were adjusted several times and set as low as 30 meters as the plane descended into Barcelona. They said the co-pilot, Andreas Lubitz, was alone in the cockpit during the flight to Barcelona, as he was when the Germanwings plane made its ill-fated return journey to Düsseldorf, Germany, hours later. The revelation that Lubitz may have rehearsed a controlled descent of the plane appears to support the assumption that the crash, which killed 150 people, was not only deliberate, but also premeditated. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Saudi Arabia, where he plans to push Saudi leaders to accept a humanitarian pause in their military campaign against Shiite Houthi rebels in Yemen. Kerry will meet with Saudi leaders and Yemeni President Abdu Rabu Mansur Hadi, who has fled to Saudi Arabia for his own safety. The Saudis have said they are considering a pause in airstrikes and other action against the Houthis. Humanitarian aid workers have complained about how hard it has become to deliver food and other aid to Yemeni civilians because of those Saudi-led airstrikes. The head of the Italian Red Cross has called on the international community not to label migrants as illegal, saying they are victims, not criminals. Francesco Rocca was speaking Wednesday at the United Nations, where VOA's Margaret Bashir has this report.
Italy and its Navy and Coast Guard have been at the forefront of the crisis. Last year, they rescued more than 160,000 migrants from the sea. Italian Red Cross President Francesco Rocca told reporters that the legal way must be found for people to escape conflict and oppression in their homelands.
How can you stop a mother who tried to save their daughters in Nigeria? How can you stop a father who lost one son and want to save the other two, escaping from Syria?
European efforts at stemming the flow of migrants have focused on Libya, which, mired in political chaos and conflict, has become a gateway for traffickers transiting people to Europe. Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi has proposed destroying smugglers' boats before they are filled with migrants as a preemptive way to stop the traffickers. Red Cross Chief Rocca appeared skeptical about how effective this could be.
So for us, it's not a solution, bombing the boats. This is, must be very clear, because the traffickers will find other routes.
He said smugglers are not just based in Libya, but are already active in Egypt, Sudan, Turkey, Lebanon, and the Balkans. At the UN Security Council, Britain and France have been drafting a resolution that diplomats say would seek to authorize action against suspected vessels on the high seas, in Libya's territorial waters, and along its coast. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
The mayor of the eastern U.S. city of Baltimore has asked the top U.S. law enforcement agency to investigate whether the city's beleaguered police department used excessive force and violated the rights of criminal suspects. Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake made the request less than a week after six police officers were charged with criminal offenses for their alleged role in the death of 25-year-old Freddie Gray, an African-American man who died of a spinal cord injury last month while in police custody.
Such an investigation is essential if we are going to build on the foundation of reforms that we have instituted over the past few years. At the end of this process, I will hold those accountable if change is not made. We cannot be timid in addressing this problem.
Gray's death sparked rioting and looting in the eastern U.S. city and days of protests about the tactics the police use in patrolling Baltimore's streets. And before we go, commercial space exploration company SpaceX has successfully tested a system that would allow the crew of a manned spacecraft to escape in the event of a launch pad emergency. In a test conducted at the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station in Florida early Wednesday, a SpaceX Dragon spacecraft was launched by rockets into the air. After about 6-second engine burn, the capsule separated, its parachutes were deployed, and the capsule floated to a splashdown in the Atlantic Ocean. That's it for International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Michael Lippin.
I'm Jim Stevenson with business news from The Voice of America. U.S. stocks ended weaker Wednesday after U.S. Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen warned of high valuations, adding to anxiety about future interest rates and a global bond rout. The S&P 500 ended at a low not seen since early April after Yellen said high equity valuations could pose dangers, although she also said she does not see any bubbles forming. Atlanta Federal Reserve Bank President Dennis Lockhart said he still expects it will be appropriate to raise interest rates sometime in the middle of the year, and that market expectations of a September increase were in reasonable alignment with the central bank's likely path. His and Yellen's comments came as investors try to pinpoint when the Fed will begin raising interest rates for the first time since 2006. An April payroll report later this week may affect when the Fed will be making its move. Most of Wall Street's top banks see the Federal Reserve holding off until at least September before raising interest rates, based on a poll by Reuters. A worldwide drop in government bond prices also spread unease to Wall Street. cutting losses of more than 1% in afternoon trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 86 points to close at 17,841. The S&P 500 shedding just over 9 points to finish at 2080. And the NASDAQ Composite dropped 19 points to close at 4919. Yellen's comments stung investors already nervous about stock prices. The S&P 500 currently trades at 17 times forward earnings. That's higher than its 10-year median of 15, according to Reuters. With Wednesday's loss, the Dow was up just 0.11% for the year 2015, while the S&P was up slightly more than 1%. That's a look at business news from the Voice of America. Incubators have been in use for decades to help premature babies grow, develop, and soon begin normal lives in the outside world. But in many parts of the world, the death rate for premature babies is high because of the lack of medical help. David Byrd on today's edition of Now explores a new type of incubator that can help these infants get the start in life that they need. Nutrition is also important. Ira Melman steps into the past to create foods in the American Cafe.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. There are many famous historical sites in the Washington area that attract tourists. One of the lesser-known attractions is a 19th-century grist mill just outside the nation's capital. Still operating the same way it did 200 years ago, the mill draws some visitors and offers fresh grits and flour for local residents and restaurants. VOA's June So takes us to Colvin Run Mill, where the 19th century meets the 21st. Carol Pearson narrates.
Miller Mason Maddox Jr. and his two assistants are preparing to align the milling stones that they believe are the original ones used in the 1800s. They need to make sure the hand-chiseled stones that weigh about 1,000 kilograms are positioned very close to one another, but never touch.
The stones have to be perfectly balanced. If they touch, it'll create heat, and that'll break down the product and make it not as good.
On the first and third Sundays of each month, visitors to Colvin Run Mill can watch the miller grind corn or wheat.
This is a very quality process. It grinds slower than modern milling. It retains more nutrients in the product as it comes out. Plus, it doesn't damage the flour as much by keeping it cool.
The mill dates back to the 18th century, when George Washington owned the property and built the mill's foundation. The mill itself was not constructed until 1811, and it changed hands a few times until Addison Millard purchased it in 1883. His family operated it for the next 50 years.
Then it became falling apart. The Fairfax County government acquired the mill. They started a huge restoration project.
The ground grains are sold in the mill's general store. Matthew Warshaw, chief executive at the Hyatt Hotel restaurant outside Washington, is a loyal customer.
At my restaurant, I like to use local ingredients. When I found that the mill produced grits utilizing local grown corn, I thought it was a perfect fit.
Warshaw uses the grits for customer favorites such as shrimp and grits. He says they take at least 45 minutes to cook and require constant attention, unlike most instant grits from the grocery stores that are ready in 5 minutes.
It is definitely worth it. You can taste the quality in the time that's spent making the grits from Colvin Run Mill.
For producer June So, I'm Carol Pearson, VOA News.
Every Friday evening, a publicly funded radio station in Houston broadcasts a two-hour program aimed at prisoners and their loved ones. The show has also attracted listeners interested in knowing more about prison issues, even has international listeners who find it streaming on the Internet. VOA's Greg Flake has visited a live broadcast recently and filed this report from Houston.
KPFT, may I have your name and where you're calling from?
A main feature of the weekly prison show is the call-in segment, where people can address their imprisoned loved ones.
Richard, I just want to say I love you, and my birthday's passed. I know your birthday's coming up, too.
Many of the people working on the show are former convicts, including producer David Collingsworth, who first listened to it in a prison cell.
it showed me that somebody cared. Somebody was actually out there that cared.
Really appreciate it.
He says the show welcomes all callers, but there are often familiar voices on the line.
We can name all the regulars that call in, and we're a part of their lives, and that's what really matters to us.
The show sometimes features live music performed by former inmates like Dennis Price.
Well, now I'm locked away.
His experience emerges in many of his songs, but Price says he wants to move on.
I want to be a good person for my son, but it is a chapter in my life, and I've learned from it, and I think that it's made me who I am.
Greg Flakus, VOA News, Houston.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Visit us every day at voanews.com and many podcast and social media platforms.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. An estimated 15 million babies are born prematurely each year worldwide. Almost 60% of them are in South Asia and sub-Saharan Africa. As VOA's Carol Pearson tells us, there are some steps being taken to save these children's lives.
Ideally, babies are in the womb for 39 weeks. Those delivered before 37 weeks may suffer delays in speech and physical coordination, have problems with vision, and suffer infections.
The brain is still developing. The respiratory lung function is still developing, so it makes the baby a lot more susceptible for complications, even long term.
Dr. Diane Ashton is with the March of Dimes, an organization that works internationally to reduce preterm births. There is no one reason for prematurity. In developing countries, part of the problem is a poor diet for pregnant women that lacks enough calcium, minerals, and calories. In the U.S., there are too many unnecessary cesarean sections. But other reasons range from a cervix damaged by the human papillomavirus to cigarette smoke, as well as many unknown factors. Fortunately, researchers have found ways to help premature babies survive. Interventions like skin-to-skin contact, which keeps the baby warm and encourages breastfeeding. The goal now is to find more ways to prevent deaths of children under five and reduce maternal mortality so children can grow up healthy and be better prepared to lead productive lives. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
About 1 million premature babies die each year, but their deaths could be prevented if they were put in an incubator. But with a price tag around $50,000, an incubator can be out of reach even for hospitals. But there is hope. VOA's George Pootich tells us how a young British inventor has come up with a low-cost, low-maintenance way to save these children.
Doctors say many expectant mothers in developing countries give birth prematurely, especially in refugee camps, largely because of poor diet and unhealthy living conditions. Premature birth is the biggest killer of children worldwide. Because these tiny babies are born before their lungs are fully developed, they are more susceptible to often deadly infections. But they could survive if placed in an incubator, where they would continue to develop in the closed chamber and warm, controlled environment. However, with a price tag of around $50,000, incubators are out of reach even for some hospitals. 23-year-old design engineering student James Roberts of Britain says his $400 inflatable incubator may help solve this problem.
It's basically an insulated piece of air, so it's like the difference between double and single glazing, so it's easier to keep the inside at a stable heat environment, heat temperature.
The incubator is collapsible and when folded resembles an ordinary travel bag. It is powered through a regular electrical line, but Roberts says he has found a solution in case there is a power outage, which often happens in refugee camps.
I thought, why not car batteries? There's loads of cars out there. You can use it, they're pretty readily available. So you can plug this into a car battery, it'll run for 24 hours, and then when the mains comes back on, the mains can then charge this battery, and then that can run in the incubator.
Roberts won the $47,000 James Dyson Award earlier this year for his incubator design. He says the project is still in the development phase, but the prize money will help him start a company for the mass manufacturing of inflatable incubators. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
To see video of these stories, log on to our website, www.voanews.com. To find out how you can help, visit the March of Dimes at www.marchofdimes.org. And be sure to let us know your opinion by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And you can email your questions or comments to voaasia at voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Berg.
There was a teenager who apparently had a girlfriend named Destiny, and now authorities are looking for that teen because spray painted on an Idaho cliffside was a prom proposal. The Idaho Statesman newspaper reports the message said Destiny, prom, painted in large pink and blue letters. Well, that person could face a misdemeanor charge of graffiti, punishable up to 6 months in jail. Federal charge may also be pending. Time for sports. On VOA Global, I'm Jim Stevenson. Golf is heading to a new venue this week as players have gathered at the Afrasia Bank Mauritius Open. It's the first official tri-sanctioned event between the European, Asian, and Sunshine Tours. Mark Tompkins is there to tell us more.
The Heritage Golf Club in Mauritius has the distinction of hosting the first official event to be tri-sanctioned by the European, Asian and Sunshine Tours. 15-time European Tour winner Thomas Bjorn will be looking for a good showing this week to kickstart his season, while South Africa's George Coetzee, winner of the Shwane Open, has just returned to action after a four-week break. Kiradek Afiabanrat is the most recent winner in the field this week after his success in Shenzhen last month. Bjorn is joined in the field by fellow countrymen Soren Hansen and Torbjørn Olesen. The latter is making his first appearance since February after recovering from a hand injury. 132 players in total take part in this event, which has 40 players from each tour involved, with another 12 invitations making up the field for the inaugural Mauritius Open.
Mark Tompkins reporting. The National Football League investigation into the possibility the New England Patriots were involved in deflating footballs for the AFC Championship game has found that it's more likely than not some of the Patriots were guilty. Quote, based on the evidence developed in connection with the investigation and summarized in this report, we have concluded that it is more probable than not New England Patriots personnel participated in violations of the NFL playing rules and were involved in a deliberate attempt to circumvent those rules, according to that report released Wednesday. That line on page 121 of this massive report again questions the validity of the Patriots' great dynasty, which included a Super Bowl victory this past February, the fourth for coach Bill Belichick and quarterback Tom Brady. Well, the report said all of the 11 Patriots game balls when retested at halftime were below the minimum level specified by NFL rules. The Colts game balls were retested. They were within the rules. After news of the possibility of deflated footballs broke in January, Tom Brady had a news conference in which he denied any wrongdoing and said about the game balls, "I don't want anybody rubbing them or putting any air in them or taking any out." Certainly more to come on this story. That's sports on VOA.
It's the time of the year when communities all over the world hold jazz festivals, and that's what's been happening in the U.S. city of New Orleans, Louisiana, where what's called Dixieland Jazz got its origin. You always hear a lot of Dixieland in New Orleans, where there is something for everyone who loves live music. That's right, it's Chicago, the rock band from the 1970s and 80s. Groups from almost all genres, somehow or another, make their way to New Orleans for the festival.
Even though
contributor to the New Orleans scene is country and bluegrass band Allison Krauss and Union Station. Finish up with some traditional New Orleans jazz from Tuba Skinny. Music on VOA Global. I'm Steve Norman.
Artists who put a bust of Edward Snowden on a Revolutionary War memorial have been ticketed but not criminally charged, and New York City has given back their confiscated statue, according to their lawyer. It was a 4-foot-tall, 100-pound likeness of the exiled National Security Agency secret leaker, appeared last month on a monument in Brooklyn's Fort Greene Park. Park's officials ordered it removed within hours. Police investigated the unauthorized artistic statement. The inquiry ended with two activists receiving $50 summonses for being in the park after hours. It's a non-criminal violation, according to their attorney, who would not identify the two, and authorities also have kept their names a secret. Kind of fitting, since it's a bust of Edward Snowden. Police department did not immediately respond to inquiries about the matter. Snowden is, of course, living in exile in Russia after divulging the secret U.S. government collection of phone records, among other intelligence gatherings. The fiberglass-reinforced cement rendering of his face was affixed to a monument that honors American captives who died on British prison ships during the Revolutionary War. Well, the artist said they'd like to get permission to exhibit it legally through a temporary Arts in the Parks program. Meanwhile, there's a New York gallery, Postmasters, that has said it wants to display the statue at an upcoming show. Our show is about ready to end its display on the airwaves. And with that, we tell you that our director is Tracy Carter, our engineer Aydin Utku, and our managing editor, who has all of the details, Diane Gal. I'm Jim Stevenson. We'll join you right back here again tomorrow for another edition of VOA Global.